I will provide comments on that water transit.
We'll start off
that was my day way back when.
Thank you, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. This is our Tuesday, March 22nd, 2011 meeting. We're going to start out with a public hearing on the bill we carried over from yesterday, Senate Bill 318. Oh, excuse me, Senator Starr. Would you mind if Senator Morse goes first on his bill?
Please.
And that one was 817. So I'm going to recess on 318, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 817. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Frank Morris, State Senator from District 8, Albany and Corvallis. The irony of me appearing before you today on the heels of yesterday's comments is not lost. My recollection is that my comments with my good colleague, Senator Burdick, regarding tax credits was to look ultimately at the return on investment. And if there is a return on investment, then that's a valid consideration for continuing the tax credit. Here we are before you today proposing the possibility of another tax credit. And I'm pleased to have with me at the table today Kevin Campbell and Ryan Grennan. And this is an issue that was before the legislature in a previous session, and it has, I believe, considerable merit in the details of the bill and the ramifications of it and the experience in other locations in the state can be addressed by Mr. Brennan and Mr. Campbell. I would like to point out to you one thing. Normally, lobbyists appear before the legislature representing a constituency. And in this case, I would like to compliment the Victory Group, Kevin and Craig Campbell, for bringing this bill back pro bono. They are representing no one in this instance, but they have a considerable conviction that this is a program that is meritorious and worthy of consideration. So it was brought back in that context. And Mr. Chair, colleagues, I would like to defer to the other guests for actual testimony on the bill.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here today representing myself and my brother. I hope that doesn't reflect poorly on the bill itself, but I would like to introduce the bill and what it seeks to accomplish. As you know, federally, there's a federal new markets program. It's a 7-year, 39% tax credit that's available for investment in low-income census tracts around the United States. It's a very competitive process to gain allocation of those tax credits. And in a moment, Ryan Brennan, who was kind enough to fly out here as an expert who's actually been involved in the program, can talk about what that application process is like. But this was, again, another bipartisan project at the federal level that just received additional funding during the extension of the taxes during the end of last year. What we seek to do is to create a matching 39% tax credit for the state of Oregon that seeks to draw the tax credits that are available through the Federal New Markets Program here to the state of Oregon. We call it the Low-Income Community Jobs Initiative because these investments have to be in small businesses in low-income census tracts. And, of course, a census tract is about a five-block area. Basically the determining factor in what constitutes a low-income census tract, I will leave to Mr. Brennan to talk about, but it has to do with average annual income of the residents in that area. And we believe in Oregon we have a very attractive map for that. In other words, there's large areas of the state that would qualify for this. What's our goal? Our goal is to seek those federal tax credits that can go anywhere in the United States. They're not allocated by state. They're allocated and folks like Mr. Brennan sitting next to me can invest those anywhere in the United States. And frankly, we see a better experience for states like North Carolina that are bank rich, or other states that just have a natural advantage when it comes to drawing those credits. The way that it works is that the tax credit, the matching tax credit, is 39%, but it doesn't go in until the third year of the investment. So the business is already in the ground, jobs are already there, and income tax is already accruing to the state for 2 years and before the state actually pays a single dollar in tax credits. Because we've had 2 years of experience with this tax credit, we've added some elements that we believe improve the chances that this isn't some kind of boon to an investor. What we've done is we've made sure that there's a clawback provision so that if a business leaves the low-income census tract or pays back any or all of the investment within the seven-year period, the state has the ability to recapture the tax credits from the investor. In addition, there is no stacking of credits allowed in this bill, and there is no selling of the credits outside of the investment. The goal really is to attract entities like Mr. Brennan represents that come to the state, help create jobs here in Oregon. I would like to, at this point, there's a lot of details as you can see as you review the bill. Like any bill dealing with tax credits, it's complicated, and I understand that this will go, with your permission as a committee, it will go to the Joint Tax Credit Committee, where it must compete with every other tax credit that is currently out there and with a limited number of funds available. We believe in this economy, in this tight credit market, that this particular opportunity will help create jobs. Otherwise, Craig and I would not be spending our time in front of a committee. We would not be wasting your time. We feel very strongly that this has a lot of positive opportunity for the state, and we hope you'll consider it. And I thank you for your time. And now I'd like to introduce Ryan Brennan. Ryan is the expert. He's had a chance to deal with a similar project in states like Missouri, where they've created a similar bill. So he's already done these investments as a part of his company, and he was kind enough to fly out so that he could provide a little more expertise that I can provide. And so, Ryan, I'll turn it over to you, and then, of course, we'll answer any questions you have at the conclusion of the testimony.
Go ahead, Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Brennan with Advantage Capital Partners. I'm based in California, but we are a national small business finance firm. We do early stage venture capital all the way through very senior loans to companies that are large and profitable. But we are honored and thrilled to be a participant in the federal New Markets Tax Credit Program. This program, as Mr. Campbell talked about, is probably the largest economic development program at the federal level today, and it was just renewed for an allocation last year and this year at the end of the year tax compromise between the President and Congress at the end of 2010, one of the only economic development proposals in that final piece of legislation. So this bipartisan federal program provides this tax credit if economic development investors, and there are about 400 firms like mine that have qualified, invest in low-income census tracts and keep that investment with those companies for a minimum of 7 years. And then every year, we, along with all of our competitors but other participants in the program, have to return to the Department of Treasury and talk about results. How have you created jobs? How have you given below-market interest rate loans? Show us the areas. Show us the companies. But there are really two what you might call deficiencies with the federal program. One, it's not allocated by state. It's not allocated per capita on your population or even your relative levels of prosperity. It's done as each of our 400 firms then go out and choose where they're going to invest the money. So you found concentrated pools in New York, in North Carolina, some in Maryland, now in Missouri, but where banks are headquartered. So there's certainly participation across the country, but many states, and states like Oregon, under-participate in the federal program. At this point, there are literally billions of dollars of federally subsidized investment capital waiting to be invested in communities and in states. The bill in front of you represents an effort that we've seen 10 other states take, four others considering this year, including Oregon, to try to attract that capital to their state, one, but two, allow the value of the state matching tax credit to force the capital into small businesses, into operating companies that hire people. and that extra tax credit goes to offset some of that additional risk. The states that have implemented the program, Mr. Campbell mentioned Missouri, that first implemented in 2007, so they have 4 years of experience now, are seeing dramatic results. They have put $315 million towards their program. To date, they have created or retained, by the state's count, 3,400 jobs. 1,500 created new jobs, 1,900 retained. And the tax revenue is being counted. It's being collected, it's being counted. They estimate today, after just 4 years out of seven, that they have a 1.63 return on investment. They've already paid for all the credits, and they believe they're well on their way to doubling the value of the credits because these companies, starved for capital, use their money first to hire. We would hope to participate in a program like this. We know of at least four or five other national investors that are looking at the Oregon program and hoping to make investments in small businesses in Oregon. The federal program continues to grow, but efforts like this to both get states a disproportionate share of the federal program, to get more federal dollars than they're currently getting, but also to move the investment to small business, we find are being tremendously effective. And I may, with the chair's permission, talk about one example company so you can get your hands around perhaps how these investments might happen. You'll see on page 3 of Mr. Campbell's handout, he talks about Mid-America Brick, which was a shuttered brick manufacturing plant in Mexico, Missouri, rural Missouri. It had been shuttered for 3-plus years. Even though the market was there to sell the products, sell the bricks, there wasn't the total amount of money necessary to get the plant up and running again, even though they knew from their modeling that once it was up, it would make money and it could sell the bricks, even in the middle of the housing downturn. It was a $22 million project. $9.5 million of that ended up coming from the New Markets Tax Credit Program, both federal and state, to get the project back up and running. Every new employee that's in that brick plant is new. Every new job there is new. And the company is now beating their estimations. The 9.75 that we did was not all the same. Some of it was fairly conservative, average interest rate loans. Some of it was the riskiest slice of loan or investment. We call it a loan. We think it's equity, but there was a $2 to $2.5 million piece that was left of this $22 million package that nobody could fill. It's a tax credit like the low-income jobs initiative and like the New Markets Tax Credit that's filling the gaps in projects like that. And we would expect that same thing to happen. The one thing that we see, and I'll end with this, the one thing that we see consistently in our national footprint is that the demand for capital for small businesses is greater than ever. It's improving. It's gotten better over the last 6 to 12 months. But we have great companies show up at our doorstep every day saying our line of credit got pulled for really nothing that we did. They're not renewing our 3-year loan. They're not renewing our 5-year loan simply because the bank's ratio is out of whack. We've become the lender of last resort. This program has become the lender and investor of last resort. And when that happens, we're seeing tremendous capital follow us into these deals at no cost to the state or to the federal government. And we're seeing them immediately hire back employees that they've had to displace in 2007, 8, and 9. And with that, we're happy to answer any questions.
Questions to the panel? Senator Griffin.
Chair. Yes, I wanted to thank you for traveling all this way to come back. We talked about this at some extent in the committee that Senator Morris and I run, Finance and Revenue, last session. In the states that you have this, is it always 39%, or is there a range of levels?
There is a range. The state of Louisiana started this idea in 2002. They started with an 11% tax credit. They did not see much new activity. Their levels of new markets investment was almost the same after their credit as it was before. So I don't think they could answer that but for question. The state of Mississippi has a 25% credit, but that spread out over the first 3 years. They don't backload it. So when we look at all the most recent states are at 39%, although I'll tell you there are two states, and we've advised them against this, that currently have a 100% tax credit to match the federal 39% credit. They are desperate for investment capital in their startups. The state of Connecticut is proposing a $750 million 100% tax credit for any company that will commit to create 200 jobs. And they're specifically targeting new markets investors, our group of 400. So, long answer to your question, there is a range. We think 39% of match is moving the needle in Missouri, in Illinois, in Florida, in Kentucky, in Ohio. It would seem like that is the appropriate level. I don't believe you need to go higher. We have not seen that type of result when you go lower.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. And North Carolina is one of your states as well?
It is not. They are new markets rich because all the banks happen to be headquartered there.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So they're already getting a bit more than their fair share.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair. I think you need to put on the record, what happens if someone leaves after 4 years and they've already got the tax credit? I think that needs to be answered.
Mr. Chair and Senator Girard, the rule states that if they leave the low-income census tract within the seven-year period or they pay any or all of the investment back, the state recaptures the tax credit completely from the investor. So that is the rule.
And I might add that has been designed, I think, to make sure that investors aren't calling loans. Mm-hmm. That if you make a commitment to invest in one of these companies, it's up to them to keep the money for 7 years if they choose. So they know they have a term loan. They know it can't be called. And if it is, our investors, New Markets investors, lose their credits.
So how do you control that? Do you reflect that in your loan agreement? Because the clawback is on the investor, not on the loan applicant.
We certainly ask them to commit. They want to keep that capital for 7 years, but they don't always. The federal program allows that if someone pays you back, says we don't want the money anymore, we're sick of paying interest on it, we don't need it, that the New Markets investor has a year to make a replacement investment. So that happens often, and I think the policy analysis treats that favorably because you could have one set of tax credits that ultimately goes through three companies, even though it's only costing the state or the federal government for that first investment. So what we generally see, paybacks do happen, but if they happen, we have to make a replacement investment and do it quickly.
More? Down here. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
And I think we have two other people signed up on this, and I think we can go ahead and go through that. Marcia Kelly and Jody Weisner.
Weiser.
Jody, I'm going to get your last name right yet. Is Marcia Kelly? Yeah, here we go. Okay. Go ahead, Jody.
Jody Weiser with Pax Furnace, Oregon. So I want to read a couple of sentences from a news article from Wisconsin about this same kind of legislation. Critics from across the country are assailing the state legislature's proposed bill to provide $75 million in tax subsidies to venture capital investment firms. That's who gets the money. The crummy deal for taxpayers, says Julia Sass Rubin, a Rutgers University professor of public policy. It's a scam, said the Colorado State Treasurer Mike Kaufman, speaking of a similar bill passed in Colorado. I don't think there's anyone who thinks this is a good deal for Colorado, with the exception of those companies that have lined their pockets. George Lipper, who studied similar legislation for the Ohio Department of Economic Development, helped defeat the bill there, calling it a raid on state treasuries. It goes on. I'd be happy to share this and other press that we've found and other studies that we've found about this program. It's been around as a federal program since 2000. And a number of states, someplace between 7 and 10, still have this program available where they are not only getting the federal subsidy in their state, but they're adding state subsidy so that the venture capitalists have even less money invested in the mostly buildings that they are building. While the bill is called the Oregon Low-Income Community Jobs Initiative, there are is a zero requirement that a single job be created. And in fact, mostly what happens is new buildings are built and jobs are moved from one part of the city to a different part of the city in a new building. This, the ZGF building, the building with the wind farm on top, is a good example of that. ZGF was on one side of downtown, and now they're on the other side of downtown. The Goodman Brothers owned an empty parking lot, and now they own a five-story parking lot. And on top of the ZGF building is about, I think it was seven floors of high-end apartments for rent. Condos, they were meant to be, but they ended up in this market being apartments. And this is the way they advertise their apartments that start at $2,200 a month and go to $3,200 a month. So, yes, Portland, downtown Portland, is low-income census district because there's some low-income housing there, and there wasn't yet on the south side. Big condo buildings like this that brought the income level up, and so they were. It was a community that got the ZGF building. It got the Nines Hotel. Got. I think it's $26 million worth of tax credit. ZGF got $29 million of our federal tax dollars. And Mercy Corps also is a New Markets tax credit building. And in those cases, there is a concierge in this building 24 hours a day, so that is one new job. And there's probably somebody at the parking lot rather than a machine at the parking lot now to collect tolls. But other than that, that's the job creation that that building had. And I think if you think of that building and you think of the fact that as federal taxpayers, this is about $138 million building. $29 million of it was New Market tax credit money that firms like these got the tax credit money so they could enter into these financial relationships. The building also got $1.4 million because it is LEED certified, and it got $120,000 because it has the wind towers on top. So would you feel better if you knew that another $3 million of state taxpayer money was in that building? Oregon gets more than its share of this money already. We get it because we have congressmen on the right committees in D.C., and they want to send money to their state because they're the ones that vote on continuation of the New Market Tax Credit Program at the federal level. So buildings are mostly what we get, and buildings don't make jobs. And in fact, we have a lot of empty buildings. And while you could probably collect new taxes off of the new ZGF building, called 12W, you will have empty buildings on the other side of town, and you will have other building owners who are losing money as a consequence. So you're really putting one set of building owners against another in a market where we don't need more buildings because we've got lots of them that are empty. The bill itself, when you read it, speaks repeatedly of low-income businesses. But the Goodmans and the ZGF owners and Mark Edlin are not low income. They can create many small businesses because they can create many LLCs, but you're not getting to that category of people you're trying to get to. There are some projects being done that would fit that picture, and usually when something that has a good name on it happens with these new market tax credits, several different organizations throw money in the pot. So several different organizations help build the new school that it helped build for kids who were dropouts from school in Portland. But that was such a small piece of the total number of dollars that have been invested in Oregon. It puts a nice glow on the projects, but it's not the reality of what's happening with New Market tax credits and what you would be just adding more advantage for venture capitalists with. Obviously, the projects don't need our money to go forward, because if they did, they would not be setting up a program where you build the building, you get your tax credits, and you can't use them for year one, you can't use them for year two. That keeps it out of this year's budget cycle. You can use 7% in year three and 8% in each of the years after that till it's all used up. I was reading there's been several iterations of this legislation. There was another bill earlier this year, and I was in Seattle for a friend's wedding, and I got up and I read this bill, and I mean, if you read the bill, it's torturous stuff to read. It's really the worst bill to read you come across. So I rewarded myself and I went and got the Seattle Times from under the door, and in the business section is an article about the New Market Tax Credit Program and how it is being used, assuming that we're doing something in low-income districts, but this hotel in Chicago is in a low-income district because it's next to a university, and students tend to be low-income. It's actually a hotel that numerous presidents have stayed in. And then it goes on to talk about the nines in Oregon that got $27.3 million of new market tax credits. But that was kind of my reward for studying the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Jody. Any questions of Jody?
No?
Go ahead, please.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. And like Jody, we've been studying tax credits and the New Market Tax Credit since, I believe, 2007 or 9. We, too, have concerns. 39% on an investment is a good return. 78% on an investment is an even better return. And I respect Senator Morrison's opening, who talked about the return on investment. Well, it's a return on investment for the private world, the people who finance the buildings. It's not necessarily a return on investment for the citizens of Oregon who've given this tax credit and haven't been able to pay for 400 teachers in the Salem-Keizer School District. Jody mentioned that in the first rounds that Oregon did quite well on non-real estate new market tax credits, and this is just through 2003 through 2008, because they didn't understand how to use them in Oregon in 2002. It was $97 million in federal new market tax credits. That's fairly substantial. But the real estate new market tax credits for that same period of time, and I'm reminding you we have no 2009 and 2010 data because it hasn't been released yet. From 2003 to 2008, it was $276 million in federal new market tax credits. In the bill, particularly, it says that the people who get these credits have to report on the jobs created or the jobs retained. There is no requirement to create jobs. There's just a requirement to say if you did retain or if you did create. And take the Mercy Corps building in Portland that used new market tax credits. They moved their staff from different places in Portland to one location and considered that job creation. We think that there are better uses for Oregon's tax dollars, and I would be happy to entertain questions. Thank you for letting us testify.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. Joe?
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer. My name is Joe Esmond. Joe Esmond with the IBW 48. I didn't expect to speak on this bill, but I do want to clarify what a job is. Probably those three buildings probably put 500 people to work in construction. It's a job. Is it a permanent job? No. We're construction, we work ourselves out of a job. That's the nature of the beast. Those people pay taxes. Those people had health care. Those people get a pension. So those jobs should be included. And probably the average wage is probably $50 an hour plus. Okay, that's the whole package. So jobs were produced. I'm not going to go into the tax stuff because I don't do my own taxes. But I want to emphasize, because I get a little frustrated that people dismiss what we do. We pay taxes. We have schools that are not funded by anyone. Right here, I'm paying out of my pocket $1.50 an hour to train people. Anyway, I'll calm down, and I probably won't answer any questions. But if you have some, shoot.
Thank you, Joe. Anybody want to venture a question?
No, but I want to talk to him. Joe, thank you. Thank you for coming up here and testifying. I think that's brilliant. I'm glad you did. I wasn't going to talk on this bill, but I'm a huge fan of what happened to the Mercy Corps building. I think that was a huge success, and I think that the mindset in Oregon that we hate capital drives me crazy. If there's one thing that keeps our economy stuck is the fact that we just do not want new capital in our state at all. So I'm thankful that you did that, and I'm thankful that you actually understand that, yeah, you don't just buy a building, you actually build it.
Right.
Thank you.
Just want to quickly say, if I may, through the chair.
You can.
I'm done, thank you. Thanks, Jason.
Quick while you're ahead, huh?
I'm learning.
Anybody else who wishes to comment on Senate Bill 817? You want to take another shot? No? No?
Let's do it. Would it be helpful? We do have a response.
If you want to take a minute.
We don't. I got the look. I got it.
Okay, for the record, Richard, do you want to introduce this?
We did get a letter from Denny Doyle, mayor of Beaverton, in support of the measure.
Okay, we are closed public hearing on Senate Bill, whatever it is. 817, and we will reopen on Senate Bill 318. Senator, would you like to speak on 318?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 318 references a tax credit that I sponsored. I must have been in 03. It might have been 01. Actually, as I look at the statute, it was 05. So I nailed down. I got there. So, but this was a specific project for a specific idea related to building water transit vessels in facilities that are basically mothballed on the Willamette River in downtown Portland. And it wouldn't hurt my feelings if this particular credit went away. But I'd also argue that it doesn't cost anybody anything to leave it on the books. It's a small credit of $5,000, and it's only applicable if people come in and hire people to work. It's a credit based on a percentage of employees or wages paid to employees. So that was the crux of it. Unfortunately, the deal that was being worked on by a group in Portland never came together, and this particular credit was never utilized. Again, if it was erased off the books, it wouldn't make a world of difference to anybody. But if it's left on the books, at some point in time, it might be utilized. So that's the crux of it, and that's the reason that you have it in the books at ORS 315-517.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions of the Senator? There are none. That's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Do we have a letter on this?
Nope.
No letter on this one. Okay. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 318, and we will open public hearing on Senate Bill 685.
Richard? Yep. Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 685 extends the sunset for tax credits for insurers providing workers' compensation insurance. And there is a revenue impact statement issued. And you can start with the department. We'll give you an overview.
Where's Lou Savage? There he is. And John Powell, you want to come up? You're the only two that have signed up.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, my name is Lou Savage. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I am here because our folks are involved in our Ways and Means budget hearing this week, and otherwise there'd be someone with a higher tax IQ up at the desk today. But fortunately, I have a certified smart person next to me, and as I mentioned to Senator Byer, I can use the nuclear option. I have one of our actuaries in the back of the room, so just in case things get very detailed. I am not sure whether you folks have discussed the retaliatory tax issue yet, but it's relevant for both of the bills that you've asked us to comment on today, both Senate Bill 685 and 686. Mr. Powell may mention that as well, but I just thought I'd briefly go over what a retaliatory tax is, because it does involve the calculation of how these taxes would work, or these tax credits would work. A retaliatory tax is charged to a non-domestic insurance company that is an insurance company doing business in Oregon but domiciled in another state if that company's home state imposes a tax burden on Oregon insurance companies higher than the tax burden imposed by Oregon on insurance companies doing business here. So the calculation of a retaliatory tax requires knowing the tax imposed by Oregon on the non-domestic company and the tax that would be imposed on a similar Oregon company in the non-domestic's home state. So, for example, Oregon imposes a corporate excise tax on all insurance companies doing business in Oregon, and Oregon also imposes various fees and assessments on insurance companies depending upon their business line. The total of these taxes and assessments gives us the Oregon base. We then calculate the tax base for other states, which could include excise taxes, gross premium taxes, assessments, surcharges, and other types of fees. If the other state's tax base, if the other state's base is higher than Oregon's, we would charge that state's insurance company a retaliatory tax at a rate equal to the difference between their tax base and Oregon's. And this calculation is fairly complicated. We have a couple of folks in the insurance division whose job it is to make those calculations based on information provided by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. So an increase in an Oregon tax or taking away a credit would reduce the retaliatory tax that the state gets. And that retaliatory tax actually goes to the general fund. It's collected by DCBS, but it goes directly to the general fund. So for both of these bills, that calculation impacts what the net effect of a credit would be. With respect to this first bill, 685, workers' compensation insurers pay two types of taxes. One is the corporate excise tax, which is basically the income tax, and the second is the premium assessment. This bill that you have in front of you only impacts one of those tax credits, and I think Mr. Powell will probably speak about that. It only impacts the excise tax, and not the retaliatory assessment tax. So, in that sense, you have domestic insurers who will get this tax credit taken away, but non-domestics will still have the credit for the retaliatory tax. For everyone, the credit will impact the bottom line for insurers, and as a consequence will benefit employers. So really, that's about all we would want to comment on. If you are in the process of looking at numbers, we have some folks who can help you with that, but we'd want some direction from the committee on that before we start doing that for you. We have to answer any questions I can, or I'll bring up Ray if we need to do that.
Questions?
Mr. Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Powell, representing Liberty Mutual Insurance Companies and Liberty Rights Workers' Compensation in Oregon and around the nation. And, Mr. Chairman, I can't spell retaliatory, and I can barely say it. And I think Lou did a decent job of describing the one of the equity issues in this whole area, and that is domestic insurers could be penalized, I guess, without the extension of this credit. And we think, in all fairness, that the taxes that are paid, many of which and assessments, which go to fund programs for injured workers, are really a transfer of the funds from the employer base paying the premium to agencies of government. And for those reasons, we believe that this tax credit should be extended for the benefit of all Oregonians.
Questions, Mr. Powell?
None. Thank you, John. Lou? That's all I have signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 685? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 685 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 686. Richard.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 686 extends tax credits for insurers transacting fire insurance. There's a revenue impact, and we have Lou Savage again to give an overview.
Well, there you are.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is, I think, a less complicated issue for the committee with respect to the tax credit. Fire insurance premium taxes are used to fund the Office of the State Fire Marshal. The effect of this tax treatment results in a credit, and as I mentioned before about the retaliatory tax issue, this reduction is offset by an increase in the retaliatory tax, and if the credit were repealed, insurers would be required to pay the gross premium tax. It's assumed that the increased cost to the insurer would be passed on to the policyholders. So the impact would mainly be borne by policyholders of the domestic insurers and the foreign insurers that have a lower tax rate than Oregon's. The foreign insurers with a higher tax rate basically would have the retaliatory tax equal that out. So, again, taking this tax credit away would injure domestic insurers more than it would insurers that are domiciled in another state.
Okay. Questions of Lou again? Seeing none, let's see here. We got Mr. Powell, Mr. Miller, Mr. Groner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ralph Groner representing AFSCME. in support of Senate Bill 686. Rather quickly, some years ago, we were in trouble because of the economy. We funded a variety of programs, namely arson in the state police, and our entire investigation, we represent those folks, as well as the fire marshal, which does a wide variety of things that are preventative, educational, as well as investigatory. And then our DPSST, also our members, teach the fire. So we had to come together with industry, the insurance industry, thank you, and the fire chiefs and the cities of Oregon. I sat and watched, and they developed what's called FIPT to all of us, the fire insurance premium tax you see on your home, a couple bucks, and that is collected to help us with our fire training section, our police use arson unit, and our training at DPST for firefighters. Last year alone, 12,000 firefighters were trained in Oregon, usually in their own region, and 80% of those were volunteers. The importance of this can't be overstated, in that without this, we would have failed to continue the programs we've had in Oregon and depend on. So in the end, I really hope next session, and I hope John Powell does, that I don't view this as a tax credit. And I don't even understand why we ever had it as a tax credit, because this is collected by the fire insurance industry, passed on to DPST, and then disseminated to the various factors, such as state police, fire, etc., DPST. They do not receive a benefit for doing this. As a matter of fact, they do this without receiving any benefit from the tax credit directly. So to me, it's a pass-through. And it provides benefits to the industry in that it reduces fires, and it provides benefits to the homeowners in that we now have wider, broader homeowner and fire insurance in this state, and it provides the training and the education we need to keep fires down, and if they are fire starters, to help solve those problems. So we're wholeheartedly for the bill, and hopefully one day we'll get it off the credit list, but since it really isn't a tax credit, it is directly a pass-through. Thank you.
Mr. Miller.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association in support of Senate Bill 686. And mainly, Mr. Chairman, I just want to emphasize our support for the bill as for our domestic insurers, specifically Oregon Mutual, who's one of the members here today that's going to be testifying following me. And so you did hear the implications, the tax implications to our domestic insurers for particularly Oregon Mutual. If you take away this tax credit, it's roughly about $160,000 estimate that it will be directly impacted from that particular company, and not to mention the retaliatory tax that they'll face in other states. And so I know Tony will come up and give you her written testimony, Mr. Chairman. But I do want to emphasize that this is an important bill, as stated by the earlier testimony, and we would support Senate Bill 686. And also, for the record, Mr. Chair, I want to also support Senate Bill 685. I just didn't sign up for that particular bill, too, but to save the time, I will state for the record that we also support that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Powell, representing Liberty Mutual Insurance Companies. Today, testifying in favor of Senate Bill 686. This tax, as Mr. Groner pointed out, is simply a pass-through. And I think his point is extremely valid, in that if you were manufacturing a product and you got a tax credit because the government wanted you to make more of these, and it's a good thing, it's green or it's purple or it's blue, and we like those colors and we want more of it, you give a tax credit, and that accrues to the bottom line of that company. If they're successful. This is simply a pass-through. The insurer collects the tax on fire insurance, or that portion of your homeowners that is fire-related. They simply pass that money through to the Department of Business Consumer Services, who in turn turns it over to the fire marshal's office. In fact, I can simply quote at the beginning of this tax, and it says, and I quote, "For the purpose of maintaining the office of state fire marshal and paying the expenses incident thereto, every insurer transacting insurance covering the peril of fire shall pay a tax to the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services on or before April 1st of each year, equal to 1% of the gross amount of premiums received. So it literally is a pass-through. And that's why Mr. Groner was saying this does not accrue to the bottom line of the insurer. It is really a tax collected for running a government agency. And that, thank you for your time.
Let me be clear, see if I understand this. The tax is a couple dollars a month, I think Ralph said, that's paid for by the premium purchasers?
That's correct.
And the insurance company acts as a collection agency and remits that to DCBS to fund the state fire marshal's office?
That is correct.
And then the aggregate of that then is allowed as a tax credit against the insurance company's corporate taxes?
Mr. Chairman, I'm assuming that it would show as a credit against the income that they collected.
Okay, so they that total income,
they just simply
the pass-through shows up.
On.
Okay.
Yeah.
Other questions?
Yeah,
Senator,
I'm at a loss why it's not a tax, and it's under a tax credit provision, because it seems like it's a direct tax that goes to the fire marshal. So I'm a little bit at a loss why it's a tax credit, and that's kind of what their point. I don't see where it qualifies as a tax credit. Who other than the fire marshal, does anybody else get a write-off off this?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Girard, I don't think so. I think it is simply a matter of collecting the money and thus receiving a credit for that amount that you have passed through. Otherwise, you could be taxed on it as revenue.
But you couldn't just directly expense it out.
Apparently not. It's set up this way because you're collecting at the same time you're collecting the premium.
Huh. Huh. Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. And Tony Chadwick?
Codrick.
How'd you say that?
Codrick.
Codrick.
Sorry, I don't have much of a voice today.
Well, I'll let you use the microphone.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Tony Codrick, and I'm the corporate secretary of Oregon Mutual Insurance Company in McMinnville, which is a 117-year-old domestic insurer in Oregon. We're here in support of Senate Bill 686, and I have passed out written testimony from Steve Patterson, who's our corporate counsel, who couldn't be here today because he's working in California this week. We ask for your support, and I would like to add two comments, which you've heard from previous testimony. The fire insurance premium tax is collected by insurers in Oregon to support the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office in such efforts as public safety training and volunteer firefighter training. So the value of this credit is very apparent in the services that they provide to the public. Secondly, the elimination of the sunset would cost Oregon Mutual $160,000 in additional taxes and could likely increase the retaliatory tax that we have to pay in the other states where we do business, as Lewis mentioned. The companion bill to 686 is House Bill 2525, which was passed by the House Business and Labor Committee unanimously on February 28th. So we again urge your support of Senate Bill 686 to extend the fire insurance premium tax credit sunset.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming over. Let's see. That is all. Yeah, that's all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? Richard, do you have one for the record?
Yeah, we do. Donna Dish from the State Fire Marshal's Office, just providing information on this tax credit.
Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 686, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 822. Richard.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 822 renews the energy tax credits for alternative energy vehicles and infrastructure projects relating to alternatively fueled vehicles.
All right, let's see here. Dan Bates?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for taking the time to hear this bill today. Ecotality, I'm Dan Bates, representing Ecotality today. Ecotality is a company based in San Francisco that is leading the effort called the EV Project, which is a federally funded project with a 50% private investment match that will roll out infrastructure in six different states, plus the District of Columbia. Oregon is one of those states, and the company will be spending between $16 to $20 million in Oregon and rolling out the essentially charging stations in five metropolitan areas in Oregon, and wanted to offer our support for this tax credit today as part of the overall EV ecosystem generation in Oregon, which is one of the reasons that as Ecotality and the U.S. Department of Energy were looking at states to use this project and these funds was attractive as a state deployment site. And with that, I've submitted a letter from the Vice President for Government Relations with Ecotality, but wanted to state the company's position of support for this tax credit.
Noted in the revenue memo that there really hasn't been much activity on this yet. Is that just because not a lot of electric cars out yet?
That's right. We expect at this point we're somewhere between 10 new lease-on-lease in the state right now. We expect to be deploying, as part of the EV project, somewhere in the range of 1,000 to 1,200 publicly available charging stations in Oregon this year. And then with each new Nissan Leaf or Volt that is introduced in Oregon will come with a residential charger at home.
Senator Drott?
Actually, it's a question for staff probably as much as anything. What is the definition of alternative fuel vehicles?
I can find it out.
I mean, is it just electric cars? Is that what we're talking about?
I would assume so, but I don't know.
I don't know if we have anybody who's from the Department of Energy who could answer that today. You going to take a shot at it?
I'll look it up.
Oh, okay. All righty. No other questions? Thank you very much. Jody and Marcia.
Tomorrow, I think, is the end of this, is it, or Thursday? Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness, Oregon. So we really don't think that this is a tax credit we need to extend. And the reason we think it doesn't need to be extended is because Oregonians are going to buy electric vehicles whether we do this or not. In fact, in September, the waiting list for the current group of Leafs was closed. And I called last night, and I could put my name on the list to get on the list to give $99 to say that I wanted to buy from the next group of electric vehicles. So what's the public policy purpose that we're trying to satisfy here? If it is to encourage individuals, businesses, and governmental agencies to buy electric vehicles, which is what we did with the Priuses in the past, then is it necessary, and is it an efficient way to do that? Who directly benefits from this tax credit? In October, a New York Times article said, Nissan expects the typical Leaf buyer to fit a highly desirable demographic, affluent, college-educated consumers in their mid-40s. In 2004, J.D. Powers reported that hybrid owners' incomes are $100,000 a year. In 2007, a survey of Prius drivers by Topline Strategy Group found that 71% earned more than $100,000 a year. And another survey in 2007 found that the mean income for hybrid purchasers was $112,000 a year. These are people who have the option to make this decision without public subsidy. then is the use of this tax credit an effective and efficient way to achieve the policy goal? That's another one of the questions you're supposed to ask of all your tax credits up for review. Well, there is zero proof that the appetite for purchasing these cars will be influenced by our $1,500 subsidy. We have one of the highest renewable portfolio standards in the nation. We have one of the highest incidences of LEED buildings in the nation. And Portland General Electric has more renewable power customers than any other utility in the nation. If you're voluntarily purchasing green electricity at a premium, it's powerful evidence that being green is already an important value and priority in our state. Ford and Nissan chose where to roll out their EVs based on anticipated demand, not subsidy. According to the press, Ford managers pick cities where hybrids are popular and where utility companies and local governments back introduction of electric vehicles. Oregon is part of a federal program to install an extensive network of charging stations. You'll note that the article didn't mention our $1,500 subsidy. Now to the details. Under this program, there's a little provision that says that if you're building a house on speculation, you need a tax credit for putting a charging station in that house. Now that's pretty risky. We're putting a charging station in a house that doesn't have an owner yet. What's the chance that they're going to use that machine anytime in the near future? It would be more effective and more efficient to simply require that there be a plug in each garage that would accommodate a charging station. Some of them take a regular plug, but some of them take that really high powered plug that's behind your dryer. And if there isn't one nearby, it can be very expensive to later go back and retrofit the house with the plug. And so that would be a smarter thing for us to do, is to be getting plugs in every house and every new garage, not a charging station in every garage. And the second issue is that we're giving tax credits mostly for vehicles whose owners can't use tax credits. So they sell their tax credits. 70% of the dollars that were spent on the prior group of cars we subsidized, 70% of the dollars went to government, businesses without a tax appetite, and municipalities and, you know, this huge amount of money that got tax credits and then they sold them. So if we want to subsidize it, let's just make it when you buy the car, you get a $1,010 discount at the store. Or you get a check from the state for $1,100, because that's what the $1,500 tax credit is worth 70% of the time. It doesn't make sense to be wasting that difference. The discount is 73 cents on the dollar. And so if we're going to continue this or any of our tax credit programs where we sell tax credits and most of the buyers sell them, then let's move it out of the tax credit and into, this is part of what the government does. We subsidize schools and we subsidize electric vehicles and we subsidize buildings and we do it through the budget rather than through tax credits where there's an enormous amount of waste. So I bought a tax credit. I bought a Betsy. My accountant tells me I'll make 32%. Annual return on that investment. That's what happens when we subsidize what we're doing through the tax code with marketable tax credits rather than through programs. If the credit fully sunsets, what happens? People keep buying probably the same number of cars. It doesn't really make sense that we would subsidize the car or the charging station for a house when the child has to go to school in a class of 400 kids, of 40 kids. It's not where our priority should be. We believe this is one of the subsidies that should be discontinued.
Thank you, Marcia.
Marcia Kelly, American Association University Women Public Policy Advocate. A
AAUW has, for the last 10 years, taken a look at the way the state is funding our services and the way that we are funding tax credits. And we believe that this tax credit is not necessary for the public purpose that it's intended, because of the fact that we do have a very green group of people in Oregon. Our household's one of them. We buy alternative wind sources from PGE. We get little coupons back and thank us once every quarter. They've now started sending us little notes in email instead so that it doesn't take paper and postage. But this tax credit for the car is just like a lot of other good tax credits, a good idea, but not necessarily a fiscally responsible thing for the state of Oregon to be doing. When I go down to the convention in Ashland in about 3 weeks, I expect that one of the questions that I'll be asked when we have our town hall is, Marcia, how are you doing on tax credits? Have you gotten rid of any of the tax credits? Because we have educated our members about them and the fact that the public purpose for funding services in the state needs to be balanced against the public purpose of giving tax credits to people who probably don't need this tax credit and will be incented to buy the car anyway. Thank you for allowing us to testify.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Rudd.
I have a comment, and that is, as it is right now, at least it's my understanding, and I think it's kind of obvious, if you have a full electric car, you're not paying highway tax via the gasoline, and so in that way, it's a subsidy in itself, and so I just think that needs to be put on the record as well.
You want to take a shot at that?
I think that there actually is some legislation proposed to do something for the electric cars. I can have somebody get back to you on that.
Oh, I think Senator Starr will be bringing that to our attention. It's roughed up.
But I just don't know what the bill number is, but I believe that there is a proposal to take care of that, because, yes, that would be even more inequitable. Thank you.
More? Thank you both. Joe. You guys install these things.
Joe Resnick from the IBW Local 48. The IBW is the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. These are the people who will be installing the charging stations. We took an early position on this about 2.5 years ago. I've been running after this work, positioning ourselves to provide work for our members, even though it's a construction job. I've lobbied for more businesses to come here, working with PGE, Charlie Alcock, to attract. This is a good place to do business. And I'm not shy. Yesterday, U.S. Secretary of Transportation was in town, and I went to an event at Oregon Iron Works with streetcars, which are made in America, some with tax credits, some without. So I asked him, and he had been here about a year ago, and I asked them, what's the future of EV in the country? You know, what are you guys seeing? You know, the bigger picture. And he went on and said, soon we'll be installing charging stations. And I said, well, we probably have 40 or 50 installed right now on the commercial installations in the valley. And he says, well, that's one of the reasons why basically we bring money to Oregon, because we are way ahead of the curve. So it isn't only the cars, but it's the fleet things which are more important. My pension funds are invested in energy storage for one, and EV vans for another. It isn't often I use the acronym GHG, but I will hear it does save CO2 reduction. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'd be happy, now that I'm calmed down, to answer them.
Thank you, Joe. Fred.
Actually, if we were to remove the vehicles from this, you'd still, that would leave the stations, which I do think needs to be subsidized. That would take care of your problem, would it not?
I believe so, but I'm not an auto dealer, so don't hold it against me. Mm. But the installation in the homes is pretty simple. It's basically it's a green job, but it's damn it's a job we've been doing for 100 years. You're putting some plugs in.
That sounds okay. Good.
220 plug with a different design.
There you go. And the 480 fast charge. We've been working with OTA on that. So.
Anyone else?
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.
Let's see. That's the last person I've signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? Yeah. Mr. Bauer!
Thank you.
Gas charging stations?
Chair Bauer, members of the committee. My name is Gary Bauer. I'm with Northwest Natural, and I thought I would try to respond to the question about are there other alternative vehicles, and yes, there are natural gas vehicles, which would come under this legislation. You don't see many in the passenger vehicle. Actually, the state has quite a few in their fleet. You don't see many in a residential section. We are getting actually a lot of inquiries on the commercial side right now from various fleets that are looking to modify their trucks or buy new trucks and put in compressed natural gas. If you take one refuse truck, garbage truck, and convert it to natural gas, from a pollution standpoint, it's equal to about 325 cars coming off the road. So there is some value, I think, to the state if you look at it in terms of a pollution issue. I just thought I would try to answer that question for you. Thank you.
That was Fred's Senator Gerard's concern, is he wanted to reduce CO2.
Of course they were.
Thank you.
Thank you. Does that get
your
question?
Can I ask one?
Gary?
Biodiesel, is that included or not?
I think it may be.
Okay. We'll get that answer.
Separate issue. Sorry.
All right.
More?
Nope, I'm good.
Anyone else?
Would you like me to define that?
Sure. Come on down.
Well, I won't.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Lisa Pinero of the Oregon Department of Energy. ORS 469-160 defines what an alternative fuel vehicle means. It means a motor vehicle is defined in the DMV driver's code statutes. That is manufactured or modified to use an alternative fuel, including but not limited to electricity, natural gas, ethanol, methanol, propane, and any other fuel approved in rule that produces less exhaust emissions than vehicles fueled by gasoline or diesel.
So biodiesel is not included.
Biodiesel is not included.
Okay.
Yep. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Seeing none, Richard, for the record.
We got a letter from the City of Eugene in support of 822.
Okay, so we were going to close on 822, and our last bill today, I think, is Senate Bill 903. And, Richard, go ahead.
Senate Bill 903 precludes the Department of Energy from enacting any rules relating to biomass tax credits if the overall thermal conversion efficiency rate exceeds 20% for the facility that converts biomass to heat or electric energy that was placed in service before January 2008. We did receive substantial material from the Department of Energy on this. I believe that's being passed out at that time, including going over the specific questions of the tax credit committee.
Well, Senator Edwards.
Mr. Chair. Ready?
Go for it.
For the record, my name is Chris Edwards, State Senator in North Eugene, West Eugene, Junction City. I'm here to present a little bit of background information about Senate Bill 903. I do apologize that we don't have some of the affected individuals that are at the heart of this bill. We missed that it was scheduled today. that's our fault, and didn't make sure that folks from a specific facility named Biomass One in White City, Senator Atkinson's district, failed to make sure that they knew that this bill was up today. So I'm going to do my best, not being an expert in biomass and cogeneration power, to present to you a little bit of background, because I do know something about the industry, as I spent my 8 years prior to the legislature working in the industry. So by way of background, most if not all but one biomass energy facilities in the state of Oregon are cogeneration facilities. What's unique about Biomass One in White City is that they are a standalone facility, so they're not doing cogeneration. So they are a small power producer. It's my understanding. Now we're getting into territory that where I'm my knowledge is very thin, but under federal regulation, I understand that they're regulated as a small power producer, not as a cogeneration facility. They have 60 employees, and they depend upon those 60 employees, their suppliers, the truckers, the loggers. They depend upon the biomass collection tax credit as part of the economic stream to make biomass collection and utilization in that area of the state economical. They're not attached to a sawmill, and I think that it's quite relevant to this discussion that some of the areas in the state where we most need to incentivize biomass power are those areas like the east side of the mountains and like southern Oregon, where there's not much of an industry left. And that's the irony of it all, is the fact that there's not much of an industry left, there is all the more reason you need the tax credit, because they're not attached to a sawmill. They're not attached to a veneer plant or some other type of wood products manufacturing facility. So, we have a biomass. There are, a bunch of reasons why biomass power is good. It's forest health, it's rural jobs, and it's energy policy. And so this last year, the Department of Energy entered into a rulemaking process which constrained the use of the biomass collection tax credit to facilities that meet a minimum energy conversion efficiency rating. And those are found, I understand, in a specific federal statute or federal rules, this particular facility in White City cannot meet, nor will they ever be able to meet as a standalone power producer, those type of energy efficiency requirements. And so they've been, through the rulemaking process, essentially cut out of being able to benefit from this tax credit. And they're one of the only games in town in an area of the state where we need them. And so we've brought this bill forth to say that, well, those rules cannot require that a biomass facility have an energy conversion efficiency rating, or whatever it's called, of more than a minimal, may not include a minimum overall thermal conversion efficiency rating that exceeds 20%. And that, in fact, would allow a standalone facility like this in White City to continue to benefit from the tax credit, which is needed in that area of the state. The economics of the industry just do not make it pencil to be able to go out and collect biomass in the woods and bring it in, burn it, and sell it for power. So, hence the bill.
Hence the bill. Okay. Any questions of the senator?
There's none. Thank you. We have a long letter in here from the department. Anybody else wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, is there any additional information? Did we enter that into the record?
Yep, I entered it in.
So that takes us to the end of our agenda today. Is there anything additional for the committee? There is none. Thank you, everyone. We are adjourned.